Welcome to New Realities. I'm Alan Steinfeld, and this program is about the evolution of consciousness. And I can't think of a better person who's really on that mission to evolve consciousness spiritually, politically, philosophically, than tonight's guest, Steve Dynan. He's the founder of the Shift Network, and he's also the author of this new book called Sacred America, Fulfilling Our Mission in Service to All. You can hear New York City in the background there, yeah. Stephen. That's New York.
It creates a real sense of urgency. I like it.
That's what your book is all about, right?
In many ways, it's about taking seriously the challenges of our day and rising to them. So, you know, there's a certain level of meeting the emergency of the moment that's in the book as well.
Well, that's the emergency in the street. But I also want to say the book was launched today, and it's already number one on a lot of Amazon lists, isn't it?
Yeah, so, we're number one in a bunch of categories. Right now we're 26 overall, so hopefully it'll just keep building. And because, you know, that ultimately each person can have a huge impact. And I feel like there's what I've been most heartened by is people who have told me already that this is, you know, the best or most important book they've ever read. And it's really inspiring people to get re-engaged politically, because a lot of conscious folks have kind of pulled away from politics because it can be a very toxic environment. It can feel like there's so much negativity that we just want to create our own little sanctuary worlds to elevate our consciousness and create healthy community. But when we step away from the political process, we basically turn over decision-making for our whole society to people who don't have our best interests at heart, who aren't trying to evolve our highest potential necessarily. And so that ends up working against the whole impulse to create a larger shift in our society. So really the only way that we can shift our world is by taking not only our inner work seriously, but also really taking responsibility for evolving our collective.
Well, that's just it. I mean, we are in such a political process right now. Of course, everyone said this is the strangest election in American history. And also, today's July 5th, the day after our so-called Independence Day. So we're right at a political nexus point, and we need to decide which way we're going. And I like how you talk about American evolution as opposed to a revolution. So let's break that down a little bit and talk about the difference between evolution and revolution. Okay? Can you set
Absolutely.
That up?
Absolutely. Well, I think that's part of why we have a dysfunctional political culture right now is because America was founded on a revolution, which kind of led us to glorify violence and a certain level of just overthrow the old and a kind of a polarizing way to create change. And I'm not sure that was actually the best idea for how we created our country. There's Canada individuated from England in a far less violent way and created they have a less violent culture in many ways. And so I think we have to take it with a grain of salt, the whole revolutionary fire and let's seize the barricades. And, you know, I was into it for a long time. In my 20s, I had a book called Radical Spirit. I was into being radical in different ways. But real lasting change tends to be evolutionary rather than revolutionary, and it builds upon the past rather than dissolves it or destroys it. So many revolutions end in violence and bloodshed and basically a destruction of old societal patterns rather than the building of the new. I think real evolution is more like upgrading the operating system on our computers. Is we don't throw out the old, we build upon it. We address bugs, we address problems, we create new features, and we build something that works still better. And when you really look at the long sweep of American history, we've had is a continuous series of evolutions. Sometimes they're a little dicier, and sometimes they do get violent, like the American Civil War. But ultimately, we're building upon what we've inherited and going to the next level. So a real evolutionary is one who sees the and respects the divinity in all things. It really is not just trying to dominate others, but saying, you know what, we need to work together towards a higher mission. And that evolutionary tends to be more patient, and they're more focused on really creating change in a way that's sustainable rather than impatient and destructive.
I mean, of course, yeah, and I totally agree with you, but I also sense that there's two forces at work at least within the American politics, you know, there's the money operating manipulation of big business who sees war as profit, and they don't really care about lives and you know, the whole moral structure. And I think, you know, did you ever hear about this book called The War is a Racket, written in the 20s?
And no, they talk that.
Yeah. So it talks about how we need to go to war every 20 or 30 years to keep the U.S. economy strong. And there's those forces that may not and probably won't agree with the idealism that your book addresses, which I think is great. We need to create a sacred America. So what do you say to those about those political manipulations that seem to really be controlling our political movements in some ways?
Yeah. I think if most people are aware of that, if there is a if there is manipulation going on, people don't want to be manipulated and don't want to be having to spend large amounts of money to subsidize useless activities like a lot of wars turn into. So, yes, that has happened a lot historically, but I think that what is also true is people can either be, they can really be pulled by a vision of possibilities. Or, you know, when you're creating a new company like in Silicon Valley, you're creating a vision of possibilities. You're creating a new opportunity, and that can be incredibly motivating. People work very hard and long hours if they feel invested in a new vision. So I think that what happens is if there's a failure of vision, then people revert to motivating through fear. So war creates motivation through fear, and it stimulates a lot of activity because we're afraid we're going to be taken over or defeated in some fashion, and so that motivates people to try harder. But we can also be so compelled by a vision that we're like, you know what, I'm going to devote my life to this. I'm going to work towards this. This is a beautiful thing that I want to create. And when we do that and we take care of ourselves and we take care of our communities, it's a lot more sustainable because we have energy for the long haul. It feeds us rather than detracts from us. So I feel like I've got more energy every week because I'm fully aligned with the mission I'm here to create. And that's infectious to other and contagious with other people.
Right. No, I think you're doing it, and having, you know, spent the week with you last week was, you know, I can see the drive and the passion you have to evolutionize this country. But and in your book, you do address some of the financial issues. So what is the practical way we can take back control of our country and our government from the economic political forces that do seem to run it? This is what the whole Bernie Sanders campaign was so popular in creating that realization that, you know, their people can be part of a movement, but in most cases it's the money. So what can we do to take back real American politics and make it of the people, by the people, and for the people?
Well, I want to surface some things in your languaging to take it back. So essentially set it up as a power struggle with the people who have more financial power, political power. And that narrative is part of where we end up in a kind of class warfare, the occupy the 99% versus the 1%, or the, you know, taking on the billionaire class. And that psychology tends to create a bit of a schism. So ultimately what we want is we want the people in the 1%, the people with power, we want them to evolve. We want them to awaken. We want them to shift. We want them to become more generous. We want to create laws that reflect the best in us. And the way to do that isn't necessarily through this kind of like oppositional energy. In fact, it can create more distance and separation from folks. So what I'm more interested in, for instance, I'll talk about it, you know, what my orientation this year is, I'm going to go to Cleveland and be part of the whole RNC. I'm also going to go to Philadelphia and be part of the DNC. But my goal isn't there to go there and protest. I really want to go there and build bridges and build and have conversations and open to collaborative possibilities. Because my feeling is that there's good-hearted, good, you know, well-intentioned people who are in positions of power, who have great wealth and who have influence, who are very concerned and want to evolve things to the next level. And if you can find the right bridge points, then you can actually start to tip things in a better direction. So rather than, I'm not going to be protesting outside, but trying to find the people that are interested in evolving the Republican Party to the next level in the same way evolving the Democratic Party at the next level. It's not simply a kind of a lateral power struggle, but it's a vertical move that we need to do. So we don't just need Democrats to win or Republicans to win. We need both parties to evolve to the next level, which means actually shifting our identity beyond parties into our shared oneness. I talk about it, we need an American evolution, and everybody's welcome to that, as long as you play by certain ground rules, that you're going to be respectful, you're going to be honoring of others, you're going to look for the points of synergy and collaboration, and you're going to hold your political positions, but you're also going to be curious about opening to other possibilities and ideas. And when we do that, then we're all on the same team. We're not just two teams slugging it out. The media likes to kind of get us in this cage match mentality that two teams slugging it out. It could be Democrats versus Republicans. It could be the 99% versus the 1%. But everything is essentially built around some sort of polarization. And what we really need is more people to hold the ground of the higher unity and say, we're all souls incarnate here with a purpose. We're all here to help evolve our country to the next level. We're all here to learn and grow and expand. And the more we can get past the high-level political posturing and positioning and actually connect in a real human way, the more we can actually create change together. And I'll give an example from my life. It's like you can take it on as a spiritual practice. When 2008, when Sarah Palin was the vice presidential nominee, she just drove me crazy. And I took it on as a practice, and I said, you know what, how can I turn this around? How can I actually see the divinity in her, respect her, and honor her? Not even just for herself, but really as a emissary for a whole culture. And so I read both of her books, and it was actually very interesting and helped me to shift my own prejudices and biases. And I ended up not only shifting to be able to kind of appreciate her in certain ways. I wrote an article about it publicly called Dissolving the Palin Prejudice and got a lot of fan mail from conservatives, which then opened the door to other later collaborations and being able to relate more with people. And so I broke down the identification with just being a progressive, and she was the problem, she was wrong, and I was going to defeat her, to rather saying, you know what, she has her own, she's worthy of respect on her own terms. Even if I don't agree with her policies, even if I don't, there's a way in which there's an intrinsic divinity, there's an intrinsic equality and intrinsic worthiness in every human being. And when we can connect with that point, it actually makes everything else easier. Doesn't mean that we still are all going to agree on things, but it does keep us from this kind of civil war mentality that tears apart the American family and the human family.
Right. No, I like what you're saying. And it goes back to the work I did with Marshall Rosenberg, Nonviolent Communications, saying we all have the same needs and desires, we just have different strategies for getting those needs met. And so, yes, Republicans, Democrats, conservatives, liberals, we are all wanting the same thing, basically. But then you get to the one percenters, and I'm not sure. I mean, I don't want to demonize anybody and make them bad versus good. But what would you say to those people who own, 99% of the world's wealth, in order to show them that there's ways of sharing? I mean, I'm at a loss to know what to say to those people. And, and they're individuals, of course, and they probably have their own agendas. But I'm curious, what would you say to some of those people who do have a majority of the wealth of the country anyway?
Yeah, well, I think you could point to a lot of different things. You point to psychological research that shows that when we really feel like our lives are in service to something larger than ourselves, we're actually happier and more fulfilled. So if you're just making a big pile of money and sitting on it and only focusing on yourself, you actually tend to make yourself more miserable. So it's in your best interest to be more generous, to be more philanthropic. It reconnects you with the human family and actually leaves a better legacy. If you're, so it creates better family connections on all the different levels. It's like you're just happier and more fulfilled. You look at some of these billionaires like Bill Gates now and Mark Zuckerberg and Warren Buffett, and they've pledged over half of their net worth. In Zuckerberg's case, it's 99% of their net worth to solving problems for humanity. And there's an enormous energy and dynamism and excitement that comes from that versus simply just accumulating more things. And so what we want to do is like instead of point the finger and blame, we want to point the finger towards, hey, here's a higher possibility. You've been entrusted with this vast amount of skill and capacity that built this fortune, and you can make a huge difference. And when you do, it's going to benefit not just yourself, but it's also going to benefit your kids and your grandchildren and the future planet we want to live on. And so let's inspire more enlightened billionaires. Let's say we want to embrace you, because what happens is when people are attacked and they feel judged, is that they want to pull in their tentacles. They want to hide out from that. They want to retreat into more private enclaves. And so if you've got a lot of people who are simply just angry and finger pointing, a lot of billionaires are just going to shut down and not want to open up to that. But if you're like, hey, let's love to create the billionaires for peace, and we'd love to create more bridges with people who have a lot of resources who can make this world a better place. And you know, it might be that we find common ground in odd places too. It's like there's I think we've, for instance, we've taken a stand on ending child sex trafficking for the Shift Network, and you know, we've actually partnered with a group that is that tends to be more fundamentalist in their base, and so it's not a natural fit in many ways. But we found that when there's a superordinate goal, when we say, yes, we want to end child sex trafficking, then you can actually find more places to bond and connect and respect each other. And so with billionaires, it's like, well, what do we want to help address in the world? It might be alleviating poverty around the world. A lot of wealthy people are very pro-business, and so they can get very on board with the idea of microfinance loans that help developing world entrepreneurs get a leg up and ultimately come back in. It's a business-oriented solution to uplift people rather than the handout, which some of them tend to avoid. So finding the places where we can have the common ground is actually tends to be more effective and ultimately more empowering.
Yeah, no, I hope that strategy does work, because I think that would lead to the kind of evolution we're talking about. But I wonder if it does. Have you actually done this with people, you know, with a lot of money and talked to them about being more altruistic and sharing their wealth? I mean, have you personally had that experience where they said, sure, that's what we'll do? I mean,
it's a good question. I mean, I feel like I certainly put it out in a lot of indirect ways in terms of a philosophy and book and orientation. And there are some fairly wealthy people that have invested in the Shift Network. And we have had, I tend to focus my conversations with them more on just how do we create a better world and a better planet. So I think that, you know, it's, we don't all have access to the 1%, but I think that the less we demonize them and more see the opportunity. The opportunity of this wealth concentration is that if you have a deeper awakening of heart, body, mind, and soul in the wealthy class, there, you can move resources and create more initiatives for change faster than at any time in history. I mean, we could wipe out a massive amount of suffering in the world very quickly with 100 of the top billionaires of the world on board. And so it's more about creating visions that are exciting and inspire people. It could be nonprofit, it could be for-profit, it could be campaigns. And then it's like, and getting on board with that rather than immediately going at like, hey, you're not giving away enough of your money. That sort of tends to be a little more confrontational versus like, hey, how about if we could end the lack of clean drinking water for a whole country with, you know, $1 billion for water filters and water filtration. And it's like, are you game to play? You want to play a big game here? Let's actually change the whole health, baseline of health for a whole country. Like that to me is a more empowering invitation. So I think that
it's amazing. You know, no, of course. No, I'm totally with you on that. And so what were you going to say then? You were saying?
Yeah, so I think that what we're wanting to do is the basic underlying principle is to create partnerships where we've once seen opposition. So when writing Sacred America, Sacred World, I really wanted to have some high-level Republican leaders on board and endorsing it, because most of my friends and allies are on the left. And so we reached out to somebody named Rich Toffel, who is the founder of the Log Cabin Republicans, and got him to read the book. He liked a lot of it, but had some critiques of how I was portraying conservatives. And I got him on the phone. I heard his critiques. I made some shifts in the book, and he ended up being an endorser, and we're looking at doing some events together. He's working on a whole Future of the Right initiative, which is really about how does the Republican Party evolve into a more enlightened expression. So I think it's a great conversation and really interesting, but it took me kind of outreaching and building bridges and really listening and learning from somebody with a different political persuasion. And I know that that's going to turn into some very fruitful fruitful collaborations. So each place where we feel there's an oppositional energy or a schism or a divide, let's look for how do we bridge that. So as an example, we're seeing that like how polarized we've gotten with Iran in the last few decades and recently around the Iran nuclear deal. So we're going to send a delegation of people from the Shift Network and some of our allies to Iran, and mainly as a peace building thing to travel and make some friends and connections, and then to be able to share that back with our network. So it just creates a little bit of a softening of the divides. And, and so we can do that in lots of little ways in our communities with underprivileged communities. We can do it across political divides. We can do it across religious divides, like reach out to your local mosque and have a potluck, something that just builds a little bit more relationship between people that are separate, because those places of separation are what can fester and eventually flare up in violence and bullying and even war, and that's where we're really challenged right now, because we have a real flaring up of these forces of separation in our society.
Mm. So do you see yourself moving more into politics? Would you like to have more of a place where you can speak from those sort of ways? I mean, would you like to move into government? I'm just curious personally. Is that something you're, because this book, it's a very beautiful line between the spiritual, the sacred, and political agendas in a sense. I mean, you have lots of ideas in here about how, should I quote Donald Trump, how to make America great again,
What I would love to do is I would love to be influential in politics, but not hold office myself necessarily. I don't feel called to do that this lifetime, although I really want to support those who do. I think we need more spiritually based, conscious people who have really done a lot of inner work and are really wanting to genuinely serve the greater good to run for office, and I think that's very important. But even if we don't feel that call, to engage our elected officials in a respectful way, even if we're a Democrat and we have a Republican representative, to engage them in their office in a respectful way and make sure our opinions are heard. And there's a way to become citizen lobbyists that it actually helps to create more of a partnership with our elected officials. So I personally would like the book to, I mean, it's already been given to Hillary Clinton and as well as a bunch of British political leaders, oddly enough, and before it was even out. And so I would love to have an influence with political leaders and to help to bring new ideas into the process and to help catalyze what I'm calling an American evolution, which is a transpartisan movement that isn't about just another extension of the party system, but really about all of us who want to see our country evolve to the next level, feeling like we've got a place and seat at the table. And that's, I think that can act as a positive influence on our political process. So I would love to see the American evolution grow into more of a movement, and that you can have evolutionary Democrats and evolutionary Republicans and evolutionary Greens and Libertarians. And we're all committed to these higher principles of how do we engage in a really constructive and ultimately spiritual way.
Right. When I met David Kucinich, what's his name?
Dennis
Kucinich, thanks. He said his job was to be a public servant, and that's what a politician really should be, as opposed to someone working with people donating money, so in for favors. And so what's happening now seems to be with Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders, is a breakdown of the old system. Something's changing in ways that haven't changed before. I mean, there's Republicans who are coming on board for Hillary Clinton, and I'm not sure what the effect of that will be. There's people coming out to vote who've never come out to vote. But we're in a turmoil. We're in a breakdown. So what do you see as a new way of structuring American politics, maybe with different political parties, maybe new political parties, more than a two-party system, which really isn't very democratic when you think about it. So how do you see the better future of American politics and political parties and systems? I'm just curious.
Well, I think we clearly need to have some financial, some reform of the money in politics. We need to get a constitutional amendment to get the level of money out of politics. I think a certain amount of money, you know, $100 maximum contribution ahead is probably, it's good to get people have some skin in the game, but we need a more level playing field than the massive amounts of money that are pouring in. That is a huge distorting influence and obviously needs to be shifted, because then what happens is that exaggerates all the other problems. I then think we really need to shift our political culture first and foremost. Like, you're wanting to go to the structural argument about, like, how do we restructure? But really, the issue is, I think, less about the two primary parties and some smaller third parties, and more about the culture that's created. And that culture needs to be masculine, feminine, balanced first and foremost. And that's part of what I think is getting played out right now, because we have probably one of the most alpha masculine candidates in history, and our first female candidate in history. So we're seeing a lot of, like, unconscious, subconscious gender dynamics playing out on a large scale. It's definitely part of the equation. And part of what's happening is America's having to evolve our political culture to reintegrate the feminine. And we have about 20% of our representation on a national level that are women right now. It's just on the tipping point where it's starting to shift the culture, but primarily it's been a very competitive, very aggressive political culture that can be a little toxic, particularly toxic for women to run in. I've supported several women candidates for Congress, and they've told me, like, just how damaging it feels, just the hits they take. And because women tend to be a little more sensitive to the level of combat that's going on. And so we need to shift that culture, because it's not just about women ultimately, it's about men being able to have their feminine side and women to have their masculine side all embraced, and that allows for better decision making. It allows for more bridge building, a little more collaboration rather than just trying to take each other down. And so that when that culture shifts, and so I think that we need to get a full movement to have 50% representation by women from all the way from the grassroots up to the national level. I think that what Justin Trudeau did in Canada was really brilliant and quite innovative. He just said, I'm going to do it from the top and make it 50-50 at the cabinet level. And the reason that's important is that once the culture shifts, then it actually is more inviting for the most enlightened people to step into. Right now, politics is such a blood sport that it makes it very difficult for really conscious people to want to step in, and especially because politicians are distrusted and often reviled in different ways, and that also makes it less desirable as an occupation for many people who really are sincerely motivated by the greater good. So we want the most enlightened, wise, deep-thinking, clear-thinking, heart-open, committed people to be in political office. That's what we really ultimately need. And it's less about the parties and more about the culture and the incentives that we have, and also to remove the distortions. Because if you have to spend 4 hours a day fundraising, as most members of Congress do, that ultimately is, it makes it hard to do your job. It makes it a tough job on a lot of levels. And it also means that you're always having to kind of butter up the people who have the money, and that distorts you over time and clouds your decision making. So that's really important for us to do. But I also feel like there's this other level where we have to go beyond the party labels and really identify as Americans, and even ultimately as global citizens, where we're saying, you know what, we're all in this together. Let's work across the aisles and the labels, and to really say, let's put our focus on solutions and put our focus on a vision for what we want to create, and the power of a truly healthy, strong, sustainable, secure, and prosperous, and peaceful America. And that everybody really has a vested interest in that.
Well, everyone except the people who manufacture the weapons and like going to war and make money on war. You know, that the war in Iraq was totally unnecessary. I mean, I do disagree with you about that's the only point where you said sometimes it can be effective to temporarily galvanize and focus the country You know, like then you mentioned, you know, going to war and bringing together, you know, 9/11. After 9/11, the war on terror gave our country something to rally around and provide a collective focus for our pain and outrage. I mean, it did do that, but I think there were other ways to probably do that.
Yeah, I don't think we fundamentally disagree. What I was just pointing out is that part of what happens is that, you know, things like a war on terror become a way to mobilize people and to focus us, and there's some value in that, but there's a higher value of mobilizing around something that is a higher aspiration. So I have a whole chapter on shifting from a war on terror to a world at peace. When you put the focus of our mission at a higher level, say, you know what we really want to create is not a war on terror, because that will tend to perpetuate terror and create its own opposite in many ways, that we're focused on creating a world at peace. The military has a role to play in that, but also peace builders and healers and conflict transformation specialists and people who are going to go in and help clear out some of the trauma from the past and help to bridge divides. And, you know, those folks have just as important a role in creating a world at peace as the military does. And so you kind of rebalance between the more masculine approach, which is the military, protective, defense-oriented, with, you could call it, a more feminine approach to do the healing work and the bridge building and the reconciliation between peoples. And if we have an equal mix of those, we're going to be more secure and ultimately happier and healthier and more focused on what we really want to create, which is a world of peace.
No, I totally agree with you. And it's very, I don't want to say idealistic, because I hope it's not. I know it's practical. It's just getting these politicians, the people in office, to understand or to want to change. I mean, those people who are getting the big bucks from these companies that are helping them buy their political campaigns, why would they want to change that? It's worked for them. And, of course, Bernie Sanders comes along and says, no, you can do it differently. But most of the people in Congress have gotten there that way, and it doesn't seem like they would be likely to change, you know? That's what I'm seeing. It's going to make it – how are you going to, I mean, get them to realize that there's another way? Obviously there is, but they have a lot invested in their political campaigns the way it's already been established.
You know, change always is gradual. It doesn't happen overnight, you know, when the institution of slavery was entrenched, the majority of people in the United States felt like there was no way we were ever going to get rid of slavery. It's too entrenched, too powerful. Political leaders were bought into it. There's too much money in it. And a lot of people, starting with the Quakers, expanding to other abolitionists, that really had to build a slow movement over time through speaking, through circulars through media, through working with religious leaders, and it gradually just built momentum, because it was a shift in consciousness that ultimately had to precede abolishing slavery and eventually saying, you know what, this is not who we are to enslave other beings. So I think that when you look at something like that, that was a much harder lift in many ways. We didn't have the internet back then. We didn't have these rapid tools of communication. We had to, you know, it was a lot of stuff you had to go on foot from town to town and try to shift things. So, you know, we've done much heavier lifts before than right now, and it's just each stage of our development as a country, we come up with new challenges, and the distorting influences with money are particularly pronounced right now, and that is something that we have to address for the good of our democracy and really the good of our world, and to take heart that, you know, historically we've overcome bigger things, we've had bigger challenges before. And that this is very doable. It's a matter of consciousness raising. It's a matter of mobilizing. It's about getting people engaged in and talking to their Congress people, getting engaged in electing new people, but also really, you know, there's grassroots movements such as Wolfpack, which are all about getting a constitutional amendment to get the money out of politics. It's a doable thing, you know, and Cenk Uygur talks about that. He's the head of Wolfpack. He's like, you know, listen, every generation of Americans has gotten a constitutional amendment passed, pretty much. This is ours. This is the one we need to do now. It's not that big a deal. It's just we just got to do the work, roll up our sleeves and do it. So I'm not a big believer in sort of like throwing up my hands and saying, oh, wow, it's too daunting, it's too overwhelming, because we've already come a long way as humanity, and we've already there's a lot of fights historically that have been won, and I think that we can build upon that and understand how change happens in a deeper way. Take lessons from people like Gandhi and from Martin Luther King about how you create change with a spiritual foundation where you don't polarize against the people who are oppressing in different ways, but really help to uplift them. So Gandhi trained his satyagrahas to have real peace and love in their hearts towards the British, and that actually helped to eventually have the British wake up to, like, this is not who we want to be, to oppress a whole people, and we want to create, you know, we want to liberate them. And so that kind of psychology where we are holding the best interests and love and peace in our heart for those who are holding on to dysfunctional aspects of the past is, like, that's really the way to kind of melt the resistance rather than, you know, with fire try to kind of blowtorch change, which tends to create more backlash and polarization and wounding.
Right. No, I really appreciate that perspective, and thank you for making that argument, because, yes, of course, much tougher things have gone down, and I think people mostly want to do what's right and fair, and this is easy compared to, yes, overcoming slavery and all the other things you mentioned in this book, the genocide of Native Americans. I mean, we haven't overcome that, but at least we're looking at that, at what we did here as invading people, and, you know, making somewhat an amends for our past. So there is change. I mean, I think, of course, we could do more of that, but I think overall what you're saying is creating a new worldview, basically based on the understanding of humans as sacred beings, as spiritual beings, which, of course, you know, your SHIFT network has been about. But I think that's really at the bottom of these political issues.
It is. And, you know, it's interesting. It's not like we have to create this from scratch. It's like a lot of these codes were put into the very fabric of who we are. I mean, liberty and justice for all is actually a pretty deep metaphysical and spiritual worldview. And, you know, we put in the Constitution to create a more perfect union. We didn't say a more perfect nation. We said a more perfect union. That's actually saying we're creating something that's actually more unified in our consciousness. E pluribus unum means out of many one. And so there's literally a code there in our motto for bringing us into higher order whole, to create more unity, and I think it ultimately goes beyond our national boundaries to a planetary scale. So when we really fully fulfill our mission, we will have reunited the human family. We will have created a peaceful and sustainable global culture by example and by really helping inspire other countries to do the same. So, you know, I think that we have some of those things. We've got to do our shadow work. We've got to rebalance masculine and feminine. We've got to look at areas where we've been out of integrity as a country, with power, with destruction of other people. It's all really essential for our growth as a country. And we have to reform these areas where we've got distortions, such as money and politics, and also the very way that money is created through Federal Reserve System and essentially private bank interests controlling our public money. And that there's some real distortions, and there's also distortions in capitalism that we have to address, you know. And I go into that in one chapter in the book. We need to align the incentives to create more and more conscious versions of capitalism. All these things are absolutely essential, and they're natural extensions of E pluribus unum, that we are taking into account more and more people's interests, more and more people's needs. We're caring for a greater number. We're really reuniting the human family. We're letting go of some of the selfishness and violence and greed that has distorted the essential noble mission at the core of America.
Right, and of course we need a healthcare system that works for everyone. We need to stop enslaving students with student loans. I mean, there's lots of these issues that I think could and should be brought forward. But what is your vision of, let's say this all comes down, and what is your vision of the future? I mean, I know it's huge, but what would America look like and the world if if this sort of sacred evolution would come about? How do you see the world?
I see us within, my vision is that by 2050 we have ended the war game permanently, that there's no more war on the planet, and that we have really created a way to live that is sustainable, that isn't leading to this intense resource competition, that we're fighting over scarce resources, that we have the basic foundations for humanity met with clean water, enough food, and basic living accommodations, and that we're creating more and more opportunity for the creative flourishing of humankind. So I think that's really the picture of the world that we want to create, and ultimately America has to do that first, because other countries that have certainly pioneered in a lot of different ways, but because we wield so much power and have so much influence in media and technology and influence and military and economically, we have so much influence, we've got to demonstrate creating this world that truly works first within our borders. We have to see all of the harmonization of world cultures and world philosophies and world religions. And right now we've got a real issue with Islam. We need to heal that rift with Islam so that we can create a more unified human family. And so I really see this as possible in our lifetimes. I think it may not be inevitable, but I actually feel that we are likely to do it if we simply hold the vision and reset our expectations of what's possible, and to really, you know, then do the heavy lifting and the work that is required, which involves shifting minds, it involves letting go of prejudice, it involves building bridges between people that have been separated. It's really about making love into an action and making love into an operating system for how we do things.
But how do you heal something? I mean, I have a lot of very good Islamic friends, but there are radical groups that some of them don't seem like they're interested in making peace and want to dominate the world. I mean, how do you deal with some people like that?
I'm not opposed to the use of the military in certain situations. I don't think that you can deal with ISIS without some military aspect to it, because there are forces that are essentially regressive forces that are so anti-humanity that need to be contained. In the same way that we have to contain criminals in jails at times, we have to contain sometimes rogue nations and rogue ideologies. I do believe that is actually part of the equation. However, if we're not at the same time building deeper bridges and extending the compass of our heart and doing this kind of healing and reconciliation work, you're not actually going to solve the other issue. Just like with the prison system, it's like if you just keep jailing up criminals and then making them into better criminals and then releasing them to that society, you end up with better and better trained criminals rather than reformed human beings. So we need to actually bring that healing energy into the prison system, as my wife and a lot of other people have done, is like, and see prisoners as people who can actually redeem themselves, become great contributing members of society and really go through a deep transformation so that the prisons become houses of healing. Same thing with the larger world. It's like with the world of Islam, for instance, there's a lot of little things that we can do, whether that's building, reaching out in the community and making Islamic people feel welcome, because when people feel estranged or misunderstood or vilified, it's more likely to lead to a festering, perhaps in the next generation, of violent ideologies, because people feel deeply disrespected. So how can we build more bridges with the world of Islam? We're thinking about doing a Sufi summit, for instance, this year, because Sufism is something that's very enlightened branch of Islam that not a lot of people know a ton about. And so to deepen our understanding and appreciation for that actually plugs us into like a higher octave of what's happening in Islam and the Quran, and a deeper understanding and builds more of a sense of solidarity. We're going to, as I said, send a delegation to Iran. Like we've done some work in bridge building in the West Bank of Palestine, and we've traveled in Egypt, and I think that I would love to see an Abrahamic family reunion, large-scale conference that then is broadcast to the world. And there's a lot of little ways that we can extend micro loans to developing world entrepreneurs. I like to do that with women entrepreneurs in Pakistan and help to fund their sewing business. So, you know, it's like Pakistan is a place where there has been more polarized ideology coming out of there. And so, you know, you make these little micro loans to people, and that woman is not only creating a business, but she's talking to friends and family, and she's saying, hey, you know, it's like Americans are not evil. They're loaning me money to create this business that creates a livelihood. And who knows, you know, another 10, 20 years, that might have prevented the next terrorist from becoming radicalized. So we have to do these kind of soft approaches that involve healing and bridge building, because ultimately the military solutions, while they can be necessary and sometimes effective, they ultimately aren't long-term very effective at bringing the human family back together.
Well, it's very exciting. I mean, it's a great time to have a book like this out here. I mean, didn't Hillary Clinton say, I need to read this book when she received it?
Yeah, well, she said, Sacred America, I need that. And so,
right.
You know.
So it's also very exciting. You're going to Cleveland and Philadelphia to the convention. So if you had a chance to meet Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, what would you say to Donald Trump? I mean, if you had a chance to sit down with him, you know, for 5 minutes, what sort of points would you give him?
You know, that's a great question, and I don't want to be too flippant in the answer.
You need to prepare for that.
Yeah, well, first of all, I don't think it's going to happen, but I think if it did, what I would say to him is, like, listen, it's like, I would say something like, I understand that you are passionate about creating change in this system, but the way you're going about it is actually creating a lot more enemies than is ultimately useful, and it's creating a lot of polarizations between people. And it's like, is there a way for you to be a champion for certain changes that need to happen, and use some of that power that you've built up and that ability to be a truth teller, but do so in a way without making new enemies, with actually bringing people together, and just kind of lay it down as a challenge to him. He may not listen to it, but it's like, that's ultimately, the real warrior power needs to be consecrated to something bigger than itself. And if it's just consecrated to self-interest, it ultimately becomes really dark and destructive. And so, you know, in the medieval times, the knights would pledge themselves to a lady, and that was sort of symbolic for, they're saying, okay, I'm pledging my warrior masculinity to the service of something higher and more noble and to the feminine. And right now, I don't see that Donald Trump has done that. So I might even use that metaphor of, like, knights pledging themselves to a lady. In this case, it's more like Lady Liberty. There's a feminine aspect to America that needs to be honored and respected. And if he's not doing that, it leads to a lot of downstream toxicity in the system.
Right. So then what would you say to Hillary Clinton, who I think is a woman, you know, and stands for the feminine? I mean, she's a, you know, she, like many people have said, she'll do anything to get elected. And I'm sure that's true. And she probably won't know what to do once she is elected. But I do like that she's into opening the books on UFOs and all that. But that's separate. What would you say to Hillary Clinton based on Sacred America?
I would say to her, listen, I think I respect that it has been necessary, as a woman who's breaking new ground and trying to break a glass ceiling, that you have needed to show yourself as a tough fighter. But people really need to feel your heart, and they need to feel your vision for where we're going. So I would say share your vision for America 2020. What is the America that you want to help create over the next 4 years with your presidency? And to share that with a lot of vulnerability and a lot of tenderness and a lot of real heart. And when people feel that, when they really feel that you're deeply in service to that and that they're aligned with that vision, they're excited with that vision, they're going to warm up to you in a much deeper way. They're going to trust you because they know what you're in service to. If they just know you're competent and tough and that you can take on all these powerful actors in the world, they may kind of, you know, grudgingly vote for you, but they're not going to be as passionate as supporters. They want to feel the vision of what you want to create. And I feel like the areas where she's been weaker is really painting that vision of the America that we want to create and being sufficiently heartful in sharing her desire to do that. And when people, you know, there's a certain level of it, I think, that is just basically because she's been under siege for 25 years, and it makes it hard to be vulnerable publicly when you've been, you know, vilified so much, and there's a tendency to wall off from that. But she's got to let some of the guard down and open up to that really genuine heart. Because what I know from people who know her, I don't know her personally, but I do know a few people who know her, is that she's supposed to be an enormously warm person, very caring, very attentive with other people. She writes, you know, she gets people things for their birthday. She writes poems for people when they're having a birthday. She's actually quite quite feminine in many ways, but she's had a tougher public persona, which I understand. There's a need for that to break down these historical barriers and be a first woman president. But now is the time for people to feel the fullness of who she is and to also really get on board the vision of what she wants to create and be in service to, because that's where we find the deepest alignment.
No, I appreciate that. You know, I met her once in 1992 when she was running for First Lady, and I did see a big field around her. I felt like she had a greater destiny. So I think what you're saying about her, or what you would say to her, could be the possibility of opening the feminine in politics instead of her just trying to run it like a nut from a male masculine perspective. She could potentially bring that heart back into politics. And yeah. I mean, I think Obama did a little bit too, but we're. Yeah,
I think that's right on, and I think that if she sees that it's not just about after she's elected, but before she's elected, that actually will help advance things to bring more of the heart and soul. It's like share more of her vulnerability. Now, you know, I think that there is a tendency in a kind of a, you know, warlike political climate to, it makes it harder to let down your guard. But you know, a lot of the times in Obama's candidacy, when people really felt him in a deep way and felt his passion, felt his deep care, it's like that's what ignited people and really got them on board. And ultimately, that's what got people on board with Bernie as well. It wasn't just his policies. And it's like you just get that he cared so passionately about shifting the things that need to be shifted that people wanted to get behind him.
Right, that's true, and I think we need that from our politicians. That is very rarely seen. That is why Bernie had such a wide, stand, because people felt he cared. He wasn't doing this for himself, like Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. But he was doing it because he saw this is what's needed.
Yeah.
And, what are you going to be doing though in Cleveland and Philadelphia when you get there? I mean,
well,
are you going?
We're going to see. I'm going to be I have various speaking events at bookstores and some other places, and there's also a thing called the Purple Tent. I'm going to go to some gatherings that are more kind of transpartisan oriented, and I don't have tickets into the main events yet. I'm hoping actually that if the book does really well this week, it raises my visibility and open some doors to people that be inside the convention. But regardless of whether you're inside the convention, there's a lot of people there, and so I want to be exploratory and build bridges and make connections and find and really get my finger on the pulse of what is happening. And I think it's going to inform me. We're doing an online citizen summit, our American Citizen Summit, in August. So the idea is, there's the Republican Convention, Democratic Convention, and then we're doing an American Citizen Summit, and we actually have the full political spectrum there. We've got people from Gavin Newsom on the left to Grover Norquist on the right, people like Marianne Williamson, John Robbins, who are New Paradigm authors. We've got a lot of people who are doing the grassroots building work of transpartisan dialogues. So we're really focused there on, like, how do we create a more unified vision of America and where we're going and how we solve our challenges. And so when we do that, then we open the door to a higher possibility. So I want to be deeply informed. I want to build bridges and really understand more people and more perspectives. And I'll probably do some Facebook Live broadcasting there. And you know, I also just trust that when I feel strongly guided to do something, that there's a deeper reason. And I'm not even sure of all those reasons yet.
Well, congratulations. It's a great book. I appreciate you putting out such a spiritual vision for American politics. I mean, it's a revolution in itself, because I don't think anyone's done it this way before. So if you had to leave people with like a thought or an idea that you really want to communicate, what would you say? What do you want to say?
I would say to all you listening to find the place in your heart where you're have a genuine love for America, and to let go of some of the critique and the frustration and the disgust even with politics as it is, and remember this place of real love and appreciation, and to fan the flames of that, let it open and glow, because there's something really precious and beautiful that we've been entrusted with in America, and we have such a powerful impact on the rest of the world. And so to dare to let yourself really deeply love our country, bring your best idealism and practical wisdom about how to grow things, get engaged, take sacred responsibility to evolve our public process, and do so without creating more enemies by really trying to reunite the American family together. And that in itself is going to be such a blessing and gift to future generations if we can really come back together, realize that it's showtime on planet Earth, and that we are the people that can help evolve our country to the next level, and do your piece, and just really do it well, and do it with love in your heart, and do it with clarity in your vision and real passion to make a difference.
Thank you, Stephen. Good luck with all of this. Great to meet you. Great to talk to you. Stephen will be on Coast to Coast. Stephen Dynan, the author of Sacred America, Fulfilling Our Mission in Service to All Sacred World. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Quick thing. We're having the big launch today. SacredAmerica.net has got lots of extra bonuses when you buy your copy of the book today. So go to SacredAmerica.net, and you can get lots of bonuses when you buy the book today.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for being a guest. This is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. If you want to reach me, go to my website, newrealities.com. I've been talking tonight to Stephen Dynan, the head of the Shift Network and the author of Launch Today, Sacred America.